So the topic here is The Substance of Thought, and it's under the theme of unmodernism. And if you were at my first event, you may have heard me talk about unmodernism as a way to think about the persistence of the past and the present. And for my purposes, to thinking about the persistence of the Middle Ages in modernity. And to extend this theme under the category or title of The Substance of Thought, I'd like to think about the persistence of medieval philosophical terms across time, okay, and including modernity, but particular kinds of philosophical terms, the terms that are to denote that which persists, that which endures, that which subsists, which is namely substance. Okay, so I'm looking for the vocabulary of what we could designate as material. We cannot designate substance as matter, of course. Some of the more loose treatments within the neo-materialisms today may do so, but I think these distinctions will matter for the hypothetical Hegelians in the audience and on the stage, or the real ones for that matter. And then the second seminar on this theme is the persistence of genres across time. And here I'm thinking about genres as they're understood as not simply a horizon of expectation, but as a form themselves, something that shapes, something that could be considered in some way a substantial form, something that in traditions of criticism, when you're whether you're talking about the rise of the novel, through the absorption of or decline of romance, say, or the infusion of chancery forms of English, that genre is a raw material that is shaped. And as a raw material, it has its own resistance, it has its own wetness, but it also is shaped into something new. Okay, and so that's what the third event will be. So today, or tonight, the substance of thought. Now, I pick out the word substance because, generally speaking, as we understand the term, it stages the union of matter and idea, or matter and form, or more precisely, again, in medieval philosophy, or drawing from Aristotle, matter and substantial form. And when you just take those two ideas together, matter plus form gives you substance. Okay? Matter is without extension, without qualities or properties. Form can be thought of as something that is not matter, obviously, but what is it exactly? Is it an idea? Is it a substance in itself? Is one of the questions raised in the philosophical tradition. Form as a kind of actuality, as against matter as potentiality. And then you bring these two things together and you get substance. I find that combination of form and matter to be thematic in a way, and I think that the philosophical tradition, you find that union thematized as well in subsequent philosophy. Now, what interests me, at least one way of thinking about that unity, let's say, is the question of idealism and materialism, again, postulating a unity of idea and matter, whether they're divine ideas as a logos principle that shapes matter, so on and so forth. There's a great quote from Lenin. Maybe you know this one, but Lenin says, "An intelligent idealism is closer to an intelligent materialism than is a stupid materialism." And that's quite excellent, because it's against this conception of vulgar materialism, which has no theory of the subject or excludes any kind of rigorous understanding of the human mind, thinking about the connection between matter and thought, generally again, or matter and idea. Thinking about substance then, to me, helps us keep in mind the fact that you can't just do materialism and you can't just do idealism separately. Okay, it would be better to have an intelligent materialism, and this is coming from Lenin, a time when, well, of course, Lenin has a running commentary on Hegel's Science of Logic, but it's to say we're materialists. We're, you know, historical materialists, we're dialectical materialists, so idealism we have to be careful about. But one would rather prefer to have an intelligent idealism that considers thinking, that considers appearances, that considers phenomena, as against a materialism that reduces all of these things down to, say, what Ernst Mach calls the element, okay? Just these constitutive parts of reality, in other words. Not necessarily atoms, but elements. There's something different. We can talk about them later if we would like, okay? And then this works all the way up to, I think, today, contemporary debates about materialism through things we recognize as the new materialism. You have object-oriented ontology, which is not exactly a materialism. It's a kind of realism, but a lot of scholars want to think of it as a kind of materialism because you're talking about objects, things, in other words. So that is kind of in the hopper as well in these considerations. And then there is still a debate today how new materialism doesn't have a theory of the subject. And you see pushback from various scholars, especially in the Slovenian school of psychoanalysis, Slavoj Žižek, Alenka Zupančič, and Mladen Dolar, trying to develop what they call, Samo Tomsic, what they call psychoanalytic materialism. Okay. So those are some of the general stakes here, and just thinking about these debates. A lot of these questions are replayed over time. I think that's quite evident. The other sense of the substance of thought I'm interested in pursuing here as well is one where we take this, and this will sound like a very Hegelian procedure, but where we take this question of substance and bring it back into thought itself, return it back into reflection. And what I mean by that is think about it some more. We know how our minds work. We know how we piece things apart. We know how we conceptualize. We know how we define. We know how we question. Is to look at substance and generate new utilities from the concept itself, okay, in relation to other definitions of substance across the history of philosophy generally. And this is exactly what you see Hegel doing, I propose, in The Science of Logic. You see him doing this in The Phenomenology of Spirit, which is to say, well, this is it's to say a lot of things, really. But on the one hand, it's to think about substance in a longer philosophical history. Okay, so you read his, for instance, his lectures on the history of philosophy, and we see terms coming up again and again. There's a through line through his entire lectures on the history of philosophy, from Plato to Fichte, from Plato to his contemporaries. Okay, one of them is the dialectic, another one of them is substance. You see Hegel talking about substance at a time when, well, it's true, as you go through, Descartes talked about substance, followed and believed in the ideas of substance and accidents. You had John Locke in the Essay on Human Understanding talking about substance. Substance is a philosophical category that survives into modernity, and it's interesting for that reason. But by the time you get to Kant, and by the time you get to debates about the nature of, say, space, where is space a substance? Well, Kant says no, okay? And he's arguing against Newton in that regard. And so you don't really see in Kant, and we're going to turn to this handout I gave you, or the table of categories, but you don't see Kant following or wanting to pursue substance in its own right, only insofar as it is one of the forms of possible experience, which is what you see in the table of categories itself. So if you look on that table, that page, in the handout, it's page 212, where we see the table of categories. The thing I'm interested in is how you get to that. How do you get to the table of categories, which are the concept, which are the a priori concepts of the understanding, which are not empirically derived, but which shape our experience. Kant, in this Kant, if you'll excuse me, I'm so used to saying Kant, I can't say Kant. So Kant says that this is something that he's developing, that he derived these categories out of Aristotle's metaphysics. He says this is a clue to the categories of the understanding, that you could add more. But basically, all possible experience, as he says in what he calls the deduction of the concepts of the understanding, come from all of those categories. So everything that you could possibly experience as a subject, depth, quality, number, all the rest, is already there in the concepts. So it's as if the experience is there before anything comes at you that you process. And these concepts sort of are involved in a process of synthesis that give you subjective consistency and that give you what Kant calls self-consciousness. Different kind of self-consciousness from Hegel, but nonetheless. So item three has, there's four groups of these things. Item three has of relation as the sort of main heading, and under it, it gives you of inherence and subsistence, of causality and dependence, of community and reciprocity. And substantia et accidens is substance here. This is a category about substance. And when, again, in reading the Hegel, in that passage where he's talking about substance, you see that he's talking about subsistence as well as substance and accidents. So substance is under here. Causality and dependence is under here as well. When we read out of the Science of Logic again, we see that the question of causality is important to Hegel, and it's also something that's important in contemporary philosophy today and the debates about substance causation, which I think are premised on the idea that, well, a person is a substance, and I am the cause of myself walking. And we can write out various sentences and look at the grammatical structure of these things to say that I am an agent and I'm a subject who causes. And it's not an event that causes, in other words, or something else that causes, which is important too, because if you remember from the reading in the Science of Logic, Hegel talks about contemporary history writing, the idea of an event, the idea of a cause, and that's related to the idea of, well, what, you know, where do causes come from? There's a whole field of contemporary philosophy that wants to take up that question again. Causality and dependence, community and reciprocity is another thing that emerges, and something I will look at a little bit later, but this is interesting. This is inherently interesting only insofar as when you look at book 7 of Aristotle's Categories, he says that substance is not a relationship. I have several quotes that I can read to you, but that's what he says. Okay. How do we go from that claim to here, where substance falls under the category of relation? How do we get to that claim to the demonstration in Hegel? Okay, and it's not reading I necessarily would expect for you to remember, but in several places in that reading, Hegel talks about substance as if it were relation. Relation is the way in which substance is thought. Okay, and so something happens over the course of intellectual history where we go from that point in Aristotle's Categories to here. And how does all this other stuff get included in it as well? Okay, is one of the things I want to look at with you today. Now, in terms of the question of community and reciprocity, just in sort of the common parlance of political philosophy or contemporary critical theory, we have this idea, ethical substance. Okay, is it, you know, or the social substance, social fabric. And again, it comes from this tradition of thinking. And again, I'm wanting to connect it to that tradition of thinking. That is, how do you go from substance as not being a form of relation to substance being a form of relation to substance being a form of social relation, right? All these things happen sort of together and they collect together to give you a sense of relation as not just being kind of pure relations between properties, primary and secondary properties, not just but relations between what is the relationship between substance and substrate. Sometimes these things are confused in intellectual history. Sometimes they mean the same thing. Hegel refers to both substance and substrate and tries to distinguish them, understanding substrate being something like prime matter, something that, in other words, what he calls mediate, and substance being relationship, movement, bound up in causality, okay? The relationships between subject and accidents. Also, when you think about the history of substance, it seems that it's right that inevitably it would emerge to have something to do with relation, because that's how we think about substance. We have to think about it in its parts, even when we're not supposed to think about it as having parts. When we're talking about prime matter, we're not supposed to think about accidents as being a kind of substance, but there are examples where it's thought to be exactly that. It's not just a question of how, of what all these pieces of substance are, but how they relate. And I think that's where, how we get to here. And then the step from that is to a kind of social relationship. Again, what is designated as an ethical substance. And we have this passage from Hegel's Encyclopedia Logic, which says simply, I'm not sure if it's simply, but the substance which knows itself free has reality as the spirit of a people. The abstract derimption of this spirit is the individuation into persons whose independent existence spirit is the inner power and necessity. The person as thinking intelligence knows this substance as his own essence, as something which is attained in the here and now, while at the same time he or she brings it about through his or her activity. Now, this passage is important for a lot of reasons. One is because Hegelianism is often associated with a kind of ideology. If you look at the reception of Hegelianism in the mid-20th century, it was associated with Stalinism. Okay? Because you're doing, because of, you have totalitarianism on the one hand, you have a philosophy of what's total. Hegel's very interested in wholes and totalities. Okay? So you get a quote like this where, you know, substance individuates into persons, and then we extrapolate to say that persons participate in society in the same way that an accident inheres into a substance. You're getting into a formulation that sounds a lot like ideology, or a formulation of a society that you might not want to be a member of. That's the sort of negative way of looking at it. The other way to look at it is to say, well, that sounds like a society I want to be a part of. But nonetheless, that's a figure or formula for ideology when you're talking about ethical substance. And it is why Hegel is so important to, I still think, is the, you know, vibrant tradition of ideology critique today, which is, in the first instance, formulating a theory of ideology, a description of what ideology is. And you can see that again in a variety of thinkers. Now, the passages from Julian of Norwich to me are interesting, because who do we have here? That's the question about them. What is Julian of Norwich? Okay, well, let's say in general terms, I don't really like talking like this, but let's call her a mystic, okay? Let's think about the history of mysticism in relationship to another term that's problematic, but let's call it scholasticism or medieval philosophy. And there's some figures there that you can think of that are in relate that are mystics in relationship to scholasticism, like Meister Eckhart, for one, doing both at the same time, really. And I mean, maybe this is a stretch. I don't know, maybe Phil, you know. But just, I think Marguerite Porrette is an example of an engagement with scholasticism, because I feel like her work resonates very, very well with things that were condemned in Paris at the time of her writing. And of course, she was burned for heresy. But that her work is very interested in thinking about different ways of describing experience, or different ways of accounting for the human subject or mind through the scholastic descriptive project or through the experiential project of mysticism that is hers. And she calls the contemporary philosophers donkeys for failing to do, you know, to give a kind of, well, what which in her views would be a, you know, properly Christian version of what that experience would be. Julian raises similar questions at the point of this, which is to say, she uses terms like essence, like being, substance, as you saw, all over her work. And there, and you know, there's been studies to figure out, well, what exactly is this? And usually the way we read medieval literature in relationship to philosophy, whether it's mysticism or Pierce Plowman or something else, is to say, oh, you know, Julian is you know, channeling Occam here, or Julian, this is Scotus's idea that she's channeling. And you kind of try to pick a medieval philosopher and say that that's where Julian or where Langland is coming from. That is especially a strong tendency in studies of Pierce Plowman in the 1970s and 80s. But Julian is doing something here in relationship to scholastic terminology. And if our approach to her work might not be think, you know, is she an optimist? Is there a Scotus here? Is there Aquinas here? But that she comes at the end of a philosophical tradition where substance has been talked about so frequently, and where the talking about the talking has sort of proliferated in her culture so much. That, coupled with the fact that you have the Trinitarian theologies, which absorb these ideas about substance, and which, as we see, also expound upon the idea of the relationship in substance of the three persons, as distinct but one substance, you get a particular, I think, kind of pressure on her work, or at least a demonstration of some of the terms that collect under relationship and or the terms that revolve around substance. So I had you look at the passage on the Lord's servant parable, where we're given, you know, a story that kind of unfolds across its exposition, where it's a parable between a lord and a servant. The servant wants to serve the lord well. The servant falls in a ditch and is sad because he cannot serve the lord well. As the story unfolds, we see that that the servant is, in the first instance, Adam. And as Julian goes on, the servant, in the second instance, is a laborer. And it's that moment in the story where, you know, you see that Julian is aware of some of the problems, I think, in feudalism at the time. Okay, and that's a separate kind of reading. That's not what I want to do here, necessarily. And then the third elaboration of what that Lord-Servant parable is that it's the second person. And after she talks about these various modes of... after she uses these different personifications as modes of talking about the relationship between Lord and servant, she moves to a discussion, and I think it's not an accident, but of the Trinity, yes, but of substance in particular. It's as if this conversation about social relationship, and it is a social relationship, which is why she wants to designate it as a laborer, you know, motivates kind of all these other things, the causality and dependence on the human soul as it is knit into the substance of God, the various kinds of definitions of substance that you see in Julian. One term that's very important in her definition is it's on line 28, 2186, kindly, substantial, goodness. We see the Middle English word kind used here, which is to say kind, in Piers Plowman, means nature, but it also means relationship, and it also means substance. And so you have the term the term of art in Middle English criticism is often vernacular theology, but I feel like it's vernacular philosophy to use kind substance as to sort of demonstrate that this kind of substance that she's talking about is inherently a relational kind of substance. Okay, it's not. And that you can't think of substance without thinking about relationship, and that you can't think about relationship without further specifying that relationship with a particular kind of quality, which is a social quality, which is why I think that laborer is introduced in the middle of the allegory, and which is a little off tracker, but in my mind it gives the parable a kind of unevenness in relationship to Proverbs about work and the, you know, servile obligations and the relationships between servants and lords, namely the proverb of one Adam dead and Eve spawned, who then was gentleman, right? It's kind of, it's as if she writes that parable without even having heard of that proverb, and that's completely impossible. Everyone heard of that proverb. Everyone heard of that proverb in the Middle Ages. It's so widely attested. And it's almost as if the allegory puts, you know, kind of wants to set to the side the social problem of talking about the labor in this example. In other words, Julian talks about the land as being a kind of treasure, right? That there's, you know, that treasure is the word in which she uses to say that land has value and produces value. She talks about the Lord as the one who renders land from waste to something productive, which is, of course, the process in feudalism of a sarte, of converting waste into land that you can grow things on, right? So there's a lot of kind of references here that ask questions, but I don't think she wants to go so far into the social analysis. She wants to stay on track with her philosophical project, and I think she wants to try to bring all these terms together in what she's giving us here. Finally, with the Hegel, I'll circle back and then I'll stop. Let me see how we're doing here. So in the Hegel, we can pull this up or get it out here. There are moments in here where, so you're looking on 490, the relation of substantiality. substantiality as relation, okay? When you move through this reading here, what I would like to sort of observe is if you're following any one particular philosophical tradition or philosopher where, you know, say for instance, are accidents a kind of substance? Well, there's a moment in here where Hegel says yes, but it's a moment that is a necessary error for developing a more particular and different idea about what substance is. So in miniature, what you have, I think, in this passage in The Science of Logic is first, again, this is Hegel, something written that's extraordinarily dense, it's loopy, there are times when it's hard to follow it. But other times, what you'll find if you were, you know, keeping score at home or are a completist on the question of substance, you'll find errors all over the place. Like, that's not what substance is. There's a part where he says accident is itself a substance on page 492. That cannot hold. You only see that opinion a few times in the Middle Ages. And here, Hegel wants to introduce it and then move on from it, still in pursuit of the relationship of substantiality and the relationship of causality, a substance in relationship to activity and passivity, which is in your handout, I didn't write it on the board, but it's as if Hegel, under substance, is reversing the Kantian priority here, making substance the prior term and putting relationship and all the other terms underneath it and within it. Okay. So I guess I'll stop there. That's about 30 minutes of introduction, and see what we can develop further from there.